When I was younger, when I was a kid, I was just fascinated with UFOs. I still am, but it started at a very young age. And the one individual that just was fantastic was Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who headed up Project Blue Book. I was fascinated with Project Blue Book because primarily it was a government investigation into UFOs. And even though the results of that project seemed to put down UFOs as much as they could, Dr. Hynek changed. And he went on, of course, to do incredible things. He went on to become a believer, not a skeptic. In a moment, his son, Paul Hynek, joins us. His book, The Hynek UFO Report. He also is a consultant to the Project Blue Book television show on the History Channel that has just renewed some more. And we're going to talk with Paul about his father's life and about Paul in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Paul Hynek with us, has worked in tech and entertainment, currently a business consultant. He's a former adjunct professor at Pepperdine University here in the Los Angeles area and is presently a consultant for the History Channel's new project, Blue Book, which they've just renewed again, based on a real project to investigate UFOs from 1952 to 69. Paul is the son, as I've mentioned, of the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek, an astronomer who was a skeptic, who worked with the U.S. Air Force investigating UFO cases from 1948 to the end of Project Blue Book. He was in three consecutive projects, Project Sign, Project Grudge, and Project Blue Book, which was the biggest. Paul's father began his investigation with the United States Air Force as a skeptic for sure, but by the time Blue Book ended, let me tell you, he was convinced some UFO cases posed a real mystery. Paul, I got to tell you, it is a treat to have you on the program.
Thank you, George. Happy to be here.
And what a fascinating person your father was. I was mesmerized with him when I was younger. I couldn't get enough information on things that he did.
Yeah, he had a really varied career. You know, before this part-time hobby of UFOs sort of took over the latter part of his career, he worked on the proximity fuse in World War II, and in the days before Sputnik, set up 12 observatories around the world and created the first citizen crowdsourced project to have amateurs man these telescopes around the world. So they were the first people to spot Sputnik and to map its trajectory.
We're going to talk about his work, the Hynek UFO Report, which you wrote the foreword for. Let me ask you this, Paul, because this is going to put it in perspective to the questions I'm going to talk with you about tonight. How old are you now?
57.
Okay, so you grew up in that same era when your dad was at the peak of his career. Do you remember a lot of the stories? Would he bring them home and talk to you? Were you fascinated by them?
Yeah, you know, some of my earliest memories and those of my four siblings as well are of like Christmas tree ornaments that were UFOs or paintings on the wall. Or you mentioned, you know, bring stories home. He brought people home, you know, Travis Walton and Calvin Parker and Father Gill and many others all had dinner at our house.
Wow. I was 16 when he came to Michigan and that infamous swamp gas.
Oh, yes.
That haunted him for years, didn't it?
Yeah, that was a kind of a stain because, you know, in the press conference, he made a preface that swamp gas could possibly explain some of what has been seen over that six-day period. But, of course, that kind of nuance got lost. And so this became an example of Hynek being pressured by the Air Force to dismiss all of it with a, you know, a blanket swamp gas explanation.
I had been told, maybe you know, that some general somewhere was the one who told him to say swamp gas, and he didn't want to say it, but he had to comply.
Yeah, and that was, I think, sort of the low point of his tenure. Well, the Robertson panel was another one, but the low point of his tenure with Project Blue Book. And by that point, he had really come to realize that the Air Force was not interested in finding the truth. And especially with Project Blue Book, you know, the 4602nd Air Intelligence Service Squadron was more designed for rapid deployment to crash sites. And Project Blue Book was really more of a PR exercise to tamp down public hysteria. And as they show in the TV show, just to make up answers for everything.
What was it, Paul, that made your father change his mind from being a skeptic, and he was,
absolutely,
to being a believer, and he was?
Yeah, you know, I would say more so than the word believer, I would say acceptor. I think a scientist, they will accept the weight of the data. And, you know, people often point to the Socorro case with Lonnie Zamora in 1964 as a sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. But I think it was really the weight of the evidence and the consistent patterns that he saw developing. One of the insights he had was that he was not really studying UFOs. He was studying UFO reports because he didn't have UFOs in some great big petri dish. So he was studying the reports. And when he started looking at that data, that's how he's able to come up with a classification system of close encounters of the first, second, and third kind to help scientists around the world compare more apples to apples.
Yeah, the Lonnie Zamora case, the police officer from Socorro, New Mexico, was an incredible case. And that's the one that really then started changing him, wasn't it?
I think that may have been the end point. I think he had seen numerous cases before then, such as Father Gill in Papua New Guinea in 1959 and Barney and Betty Hill in 1961. They were very compelling. And Father Gill was such a compelling and what he felt credible witness who is calmly taking notes while he's looking at the saucer hovering above the ground with like 500 other witnesses there on the site as well.
And that's the one I think that they saw occupants in the windows?
Yes, and they waved, and they waved back.
Oh, I love this stuff. It is fantastic. And when Project Blue Book ended, which was in 1969, at what point did your father start the CUFOS in Chicago?
CUFOS, Center for UFO Studies, was started in 1973.
Okay, so only about 4 years later.
That's right.
And what got him to do that?
Well, you know, James McDonald and others wondered why my father stayed involved with Blue Book long after it was clear that Blue Book was not a scientific exercise, but was a national security exercise. And my father's belief was that if he left, he wouldn't have access to the data, and perhaps even more importantly, the ability to shape what data was collected and how it was collected. There may be a final stamp saying it's weather balloon, but still that information would go in the report, and my father had a great deal of influence as to what information was kept. So he decided that it was better to stay there and be aware of the information and influence the information so that when it was finally released, he could use it in the Center for UFO Studies, and other people could use it. And now we see that of the 12,000-odd cases that Project Blue Book officially investigated, all with a mandate to explain away everything, they still couldn't explain over 5% of the cases.
Paul, did you ever have that son-to-father sit down and go, Dad, come on now, tell me, what's going on?
You know, it wasn't really necessary because it was just part of the daily fabric of our conversations. UFOs kind of the family business. We grew up with them, so it was a natural thing. You know, my father viewed himself more than a UFO guy, as a scientist and an astronomer. So he tried to inculcate in us the scientific method and having an open mind and looking at things in an evidence-based way. And UFOs, by the time I was cognizant, UFOs were just something that was accepted in our household. So to me, it seems strange not to grow up with UFOs as part of everyday conversation.
University of Colorado did a study in 1968 called the Condon Report, in which they basically confirmed Project Blue Book that most of these cases are not real. They
That's right.
They really kind of put down everything.
Yeah, and that was sort of that was in part instigated by the swamp gas case in Michigan, which you mentioned, because mm-hmm. Gerald Ford was a congressman there, and he got really upset, and he said there needs to be a government committee. So the Air Force put together the Condon Committee, because military types have a lot of deference to academics, and they can use an academic report as sort of as air cover for a conclusion they want to make. If you actually read the Condon Report, the conclusion states, there's nothing to see here, folks, please disperse. But the actual report itself has a lot of compelling evidence for UFOs. So the conclusion of the report itself doesn't jibe with its own report.
This is just fascinating. When your father would tell you the various cases and things as you grew a little older and older, he passed away in 1986, so that probably would have made you how old then?
24.
24. Well old enough to know all these cases, right?
Yes, indeed. And by that point, I'd met many of the people involved. I mentioned Father Gill and Calvin Parker, but Travis Walton and many of the other report, you know, the other people studying the phenomena, and of course our dear family friend Jacques Vallée, who was around quite a lot.
Absolutely, with his own theories too.
Yes, and you know, a lot of his beliefs dovetailed with my father towards the end of their careers, or towards the end of my father's career, as to, you know, the provenance of UFOs, because they'd long been convinced that there was a phenomenon, and they started turning their attention to where UFOs may come from.
When he wrote the book Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was turned into that incredible movie, and I'll always love that movie because I spotted your dad in that crowd with his pipe.
That's right.
And it was just so cool. It really was. But what compelled him to do that, write that book?
You know, he had seen so much of the stuff in Blue Book, and he had come up with his ideas and a lot of the terminology he used in the book. And he decided that now that he was released from Blue Book, he had the ability to talk about those cases, and he wanted to set sort of a scientific classification and rubric over this really tantalizing and enigmatic field so that scientists could look at it to give sort of cover to other scientists to be able to talk turkey and to compare apples to apples and look at these cases in a way and try to find the emergent patterns that he had already seen.
When he was no longer a skeptic, Paul, what did he say to you or the family about what he thought these things were?
So one of the things that a scientist does is not really leap to conclusions. You know, there's a saying that's sometimes attributed to Richard Feynman, that is, I'd rather have questions I can't answer than answers I can't question. So one of the hallmarks of a scientist is that there are some things you just don't know. And so my father felt it was important to keep your mind open when you may be confronted with a new phenomena that may be annoying. It may not comport with the grant you just received or the paper you just had published. But also, after you've accepted that there's a phenomena, don't close your mind too quickly by simply grasping the best available answer, but keep your mind open that maybe the answer isn't yet there. So a scientist, before deciding this is it, will try to rule other things out, I think. And in this case, the extraterrestrial hypothesis is one that he felt didn't seem to explain all of the UFO cases. Perhaps it explained some, because there could be a lot of explanations for UFOs. But for some of the cases, you know, they'd have to come from a long way away, kind of tweak Einstein in the nose.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of very sensitive instruments that can detect the entry and exit of objects in and from our atmosphere. And we don't seem to have the corresponding reports for those with sightings, plus objects exhibit a lot of comfort with our gravity and our atmosphere. And then they exhibit sort of Cheshire cat-like properties, where they'll appear here and then over here, sort of violating our laws of physics. So the extraterrestrial nuts and bolts hypothesis didn't grab him very much, and he and Jacques Vallée started gravitating more towards things like interdimensional possibilities.
Fascinating.
Even more exotic.
Yeah, he came up with some fascinating possibilities as he kept at this for a long time. And as he was getting older and older, and our condolences, he passed away of a brain tumor, didn't he?
That's right. And one of the things I'd like to say is that he was born in 1910 and died in 1986, as you said, which were the years of Halley's Comet. So he, like Mark Twain, he came and went with Halley's Comet.
I love
and
that.
And I took him to see Halley's Comet right before he died.
He was born in Chicago. Is that where you were born too?
That's right, both of us. That's right.
Okay, and I'm from Detroit, so
fellow Midwesterner.
Yeah, you got that right. But gosh, I will always remember that case. Then when I was 19, 3 years later after he visited Michigan, I started working for a television station while I was in college. And I kept talking to them about UFOs and UFOs, and I want to do this and that. My first radio interview back in 1971, Paul, was with the late Stanton Friedman.
Oh, sure, of course.
And what a great game. Stan was with us in Columbus, Ohio, at our live stage show when he passed away going back home right after the event.
Oh, wow.
That's something else. He was my first interview. I was his last. Isn't that something? It's just magical the way that happens. Your father was extremely well-respected. Once he got into this, once he had Kufos going, the Center for UFO Studies, and did what he did, the movie itself, Close Encounters, people just saw him as the expert on UFOs, didn't they?
Yeah, I think he had built up enough street cred with his mainstream astronomical career. And so I think by the point he is sort of jumped off into the deep end, he brought a lot of people with him because they said, look, there's a guy that's been studying astrophysics and teaching at Northwestern and Harvard and Ohio State. If this guy is believing this and saying this publicly from the mountaintops, maybe there's something to it.
Absolutely. Was he particularly religious? He was a scientist. Most scientists aren't really religious.
You know, he had some Rosicrucian leanings and liked the works of Rudolf Steiner. So I think he would consider himself to have a spiritual bent, but he also was very careful to separate whatever his particular leanings might be from how he tried to view data and patterns.
We're with Paul Hynek, the son of the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek, and we're talking about their latest work, the Hynek UFO Report, which we'll get into, the television show called Project Blue Book, which is on the History Channel, which they have renewed. And, Paul, I'm going to be with you in San Francisco in April at the UFO Con. So we get a chance to meet face-to-face out that way.
Look forward to it.
Me too. The book, the Hynek UFO Report, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the Hynek UFO Report came after the UFO Experience, as published in 1977, and it was really a more involved look at the phenomena, and brought to bear some of the things that happened in the 70s. And the 70s were kind of a heyday for UFOs and abduction cases, and we found that there were a lot of pirated versions online, and so we worked with Amazon and our new publisher that's affiliated with MUFON to publish a new version for which all of our siblings and I wrote the foreword.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. And do your brothers and sisters all share the same views as you do about your father's views?
I think so. We all have somewhat different time frames of reference. So, you know, there's a 20-year age span between our oldest, Scott, and there's Roxanne, and then Joel, then me and my brother, Ross. And so we've all seen some of different periods. Scott and Roxanne saw a lot of the early days of Blue Book. Joel saw some of the middle days. And then Ross and I really came online with Close Encounters in the Center for UFO Studies.
Fascinating. Now, the TV show, which we're going to talk about after the break, is a little different. I'm on Ancient Aliens all the time with the History Channel. But that's, you know, that's like mini-docs, those shows. This is almost like a drama program, because people are playing your mother, your father, in an acting role.
That's right. And I was filmed for Ancient Aliens today, and the crew told me to say hello to you.
Oh, great. They're good people.
Yeah, the premise of this show is very interesting. It takes real people, my mother and father, and has sort of an amalgamation of the Air Force directors of Project Blue Book. And in the first season, each of the cases is an actual reported case. So you start with this sort of true foundation, and then you dramatize it. And the key thing was, for my family to feel comfortable, was that they would maintain the authentic core of my mother and father and then place them in these sort of stretched circumstances.
Paul, when we come back, let's talk about some amazing UFO cases that your father may have talked about, some of his favorites. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're back with Paul Hynek as we are talking about his late father, of course, J. Allen Hynek, and talking about UFOs, the Project Blue Book TV show on the History Channel, and the Hynek UFO Report book. Your Czechoslovakian is your father. We never used his real name. We always said J. Allen Hynek, but it was pronounced Joseph or Yusuf, Paul?
It was anglicized, so it was Joseph.
Okay, cool. He didn't use his first name much, did he?
No, because he used to be Little Joey when he grew up as a Czech-speaking boy in Chicago. But when he went to the University of Chicago, he joined an athletic fraternity because they wanted help with their collective GPA. He wanted help meeting girls. And there were two other guys in the fraternity named Joe, so he switched to Allen.
Perfect. It was a great name, too.
That's right.
Great name. Did he ever talk about the Roswell, New Mexico case?
Sure. I mean, Roswell, one of the most fascinating components of Roswell, It was happened in 1947, as I'm sure the listeners know, but it wasn't didn't really enter the public zeitgeist until the 70s. But the thing about Roswell that you can't sweep away is that the Air Base commander authorized an article going out saying we've captured a flying saucer. And that person, his career wasn't unduly damaged by that. Now, of course, the next day they tried to walk it back, but that means that the collective authorities at the base decided that it was okay, that decided in their minds they had captured a flying saucer and that they were going to release that information. You'd think that they would know the difference between balsa wood, tinfoil, and, you know, and
that's
things
right.
like that, that would be on any kind of weather balloon, whether it's Project Mogul or a garden variety weather balloon, you'd think they'd be able to tell the difference between those before they decided to put out a press release saying they captured a flying saucer.
Did your father ever say to you, I have seen extraterrestrials or bodies?
No. And, you know, for him, it wasn't so much a matter like a smoking gun of one case or one piece of evidence, but really just the weight of the overall phenomena.
Absolutely. Did he know the late Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut?
I don't know. I have to think so, because we grew up with all sorts of astronauts, Carl Hennise. And in 1973, my family and Neil Armstrong's family spent 2 weeks together on a cruise ship going to Africa to see an eclipse.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah, we were close with Edgar, and he was a staunch believer in extraterrestrial
Absolutely,
visitations.
He was.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, the thing about this eclipse cruise is that I found out from James Hansen, who wrote First Man, that it was Neil Armstrong who requested that our family sit with him for 2 weeks.
I love that.
So either he had an interest in my father's astronomical career, or he was interested in UFOs.
Paul, what would your dad say about this Tic Tac disclosure that we've seen recently?
That is one of my favorite cases of all time. Kevin Day, who I'm sure you know, is a friend of mine, and he'll also be at UFOCon.
Oh, super.
And he is one of these highly credible witnesses who you can tell isn't really thrilled to have gone through this, but now he feels sort of an obligation to make it known. And that's one of my favorite kinds. But here you have a case where there is gun, airplane footage, radar, multiple qualified, highly credible witnesses who really don't have a lot to gain by saying they've seen this. One of the most best documented cases of all time, and which the Navy has come out and said, this video is valid, and you know there's talk of even more videos that they have. And then combine this with the Navy saying recently, hey, we've seen hundreds of UFOs, we don't know what they are, and we could use a little help in figuring out how to report them. I mean, what must they have seen for them to make that admission? Just like on the micro level, the folks at Roswell had seen.
Absolutely.
It just hints at so much more.
How did your father get involved with the three projects? Project Sign, Project Grudge, which didn't last long, and then, of course, the long Project Blue Book. How did they find him?
So you can find online some websites that hint at a sort of a conspiracy theory and talk about the fact that he already had a top secret clearance from his work on the proximity fuse in World War II. I happen to subscribe to the Occam's razor explanation that he was one of the closest astronomers to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base at Ohio State University, and they just needed somebody with some amount of credibility who was nearby, and I think he fit the bill. I don't think they really cared who they got.
Do you think they initially told him, we want you to be a skeptic? That's why you're heading up these projects.
You know, I think it's kind of like how when like a mafia don wants there to be a hit, he doesn't have to say those words. I think they probably just sort of asked him what he felt about and what they then called flying saucers. And I think my father would have cheerfully replied, oh, I think they're a bunch of post-war bunkum.
Now, were these full-time jobs for him, or was he still at university levels?
Yeah, he was a full-time professor. And I have to wonder the kind of conversation that happened between my mother and my father when my father said, I'm thinking of accepting this part-time job for the UFO, for the Air Force, looking at flying saucers.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not something you'd think would help your bid for tenure.
Your mother, was she a believer?
My mother was very interesting. I don't know at what point, But by the time I sort of was really cognizant of their attitudes, she was deeply involved, and she was the editor of the International UFO Reporter and became a valuable figure in her own right in ufology.
My God. Now, of your five siblings, including you, where are you on the pecking order?
I'm the favorite fourth born.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, so you came late.
That's right.
My mother's 90. She was born in 1929. Your dad was born in 1910, like you mentioned. So he had you late.
Yeah, he did.
Fantastic. And your mother, I assume, is no longer with us?
That's right. My mom died 10 years after my father.
Okay. But did you ever see government people show up at the house? I know you mentioned that, you know, you had UFO people and things like that. But, I mean, do you ever remember, like, the Men in Black or anything like that showing up?
There were a lot of interesting characters, especially in my very early days. But it's hard for me to sort of make sense of who they were. There were a lot of people in uniforms, and they could have been Air Force people. They could have been astronauts. But I can't really say that I saw a Men in Black or some Air Force guy coming to talk to, you know, in a hush-hush way with my dad.
Because I kind of see your father having two different lives, the Project Blue Book life with a group of government officials, and then once he became the non-skeptic, as you mentioned, he would associate himself with true witnesses like the Travis Waltons.
Absolutely.
And people like that.
I think my father felt that there were three groups that he had to sort of keep mindful of. One was the military government faction, one was mainstream science, and the other was believers in UFOs. And I think he felt he had to keep each of those groups slightly unhappy, and then he was probably doing a good balancing act.
Through all this experience, what does Paul Hynek believe now?
I believe like my father. I believe there is most definitely something to the UFO phenomena. I have problems with the extraterrestrial hypothesis, as it's certainly to explain all of UFOs, and I lean towards interdimensional and other more exotic theories for provenance.
That's fantastic. And, of course, the TV show Project Blue Book, how did you get involved in that?
So they reached out to my brother and I, who both live in L.A. We both have entertainment backgrounds. And so they asked us to serve as consultants, and we talked with our family and agreed that we would do that. And then because we have backgrounds in entertainment, they let us read all the scripts before they go into production so that we can give input and give advice for potential changes. And then I've now visited the set three times, become friends with the cast, especially my TV mom and TV dad. And George, for the record, it's not super creepy at all to have the Game of Thrones supervillain play your TV dad.
That's exactly right. That's fantastic. And, of course, executive producer, one of the creators, the great Robert Zemeckis.
That's right, along with Jackie Levine and Jack Grabke. And what they did was they brought so much gravitas to the project and also brought their cameramen. So the TV show has a very filmic, cinematic feel to it.
And they videotape in Vancouver, British Columbia?
That's right. All the filming is done in Vancouver, and Vancouver has the most diverse topography. I was there one day for a scene that's set in the Southwest, and all they had to do was go to this kind of quarry and add some tumbleweed, and you'd swear it was the Southwest.
Now, does anybody play you in Project Blue Books?
Right. So there is a character named Joel, named after my brother Joel, and I asked Sean Jablonski, the showrunner, and David O'Leary, the creator, if I would appear in the show. And Sean looks at me and he says, "You will not be born." In sort of a friendly, joking way.
Yeah.
Dude, that's creepy. Nobody ever wants to hear that said to them.
Well, that's great. And the History Channel just re-upped some more shows, right?
That's right. So we just started season two, and there's now started talking about, in earnest, about season three.
Tell me about your dad's pipe. That's a classic.
Right. So one of the reasons that the pipe isn't in the show that much, although there will be a very iconic appearance of the pipe in season two, and that's about all I can say, is that when you're smoking a pipe, it sort of denotes stagnation. And the TV show wants to have this more frenetic, energetic feel. So smoking a pipe also has some continuity problems in production. So it's just a difficult prop to incorporate, but you will see the pipe in a very prominent scene in season two.
Just make sure they don't have your dad vaping or anything like that.
That's right. That's right.
This is fantastic. It's exciting. Now, the book, you know, is it a reprint? Because it's dated 2020.
Yes, this is we've reprinted the original edition from 1977.
Excellent. And that's where the family wrote the foreword, including.
Right. This is the official authorized version.
Of all the books your dad wrote, which one was his favorite? Did he ever say?
It's probably almost like asking which is the favorite child.
You can't. You can't do.
Yeah, he wrote a bunch of books on astronomy, too, and astrophysics. So I wouldn't presume to know that. I think he enjoyed all of them in different ways. He also did quite a lot of writing for newspapers and did weekly columns on astronomy because he really liked to popularize science. And he was concerned about the brain drain in the 50s and not enough people studying mathematics and science. So he loved to write not only about UFOs, but astronomy, and to get people to understand the sort of majesty of the universe.
Now, Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out in 1977.
Yeah.
So you were still a little guy then.
Yeah, but I remember meeting Spielberg during filming.
Really?
Yeah, my mom said, hey, my dad said, you want to meet the director? And he wasn't that well known. He'd only done Jaws, really, and Duel by that time. And I said, yeah. And then my mom said, okay, well, you have to go out to O'Hare Airport. I said, I don't want to go. My mom said, you said you're going, you're going. So I went out and met him, and I saw the sort of reverence he had for my dad. And if anybody searches online for Hynek and Spielberg, they'll find a video where Spielberg and the actors talk about my dad as this really wonderful, avuncular figure on the set.
Have you seen Spielberg since that movie, since you were a little boy?
I have. We both worked on a movie together called Tintin. And so I sat down with him for a couple hours, and his longtime producer, Kathleen Kennedy, and talked with him quite a lot, and brought my brother on set also. And they told me something very interesting, that for a year, they worked on a movie version of Kelly Hopkinsville, but it just never got off the ground.
Huh. That's fast. Now, did he remember you initially?
Yes, he did. It was a very short but memorable meeting at O'Hare Airport. So, yes. And also, Jim Elvidge, I heard in the first hour, you guys talked about The Matrix several times.
Yes.
And I would be remiss if I were not to point out that my brother, who has an Oscar for visual effects, created the initial effects for the bullet time in The Matrix, which I think is the most iconic visual effect of all time.
Now, that would be Scott, Ross, or Joel?
That's Joel.
Okay. So, yeah, what's next for Paul Hynek?
So, I'm really energized now by UFOs. I've sort of been a reactive, passive guy to it, but I'm getting much more active in it now, and I'm doing quite a lot of speaking, and I'll be speaking along with you at UFOCon, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And I've now just become the chairman of the advisory board for MUFON, which is the largest UFO research.
Beautiful. That's great. I was a member as a boy of NICAP, the National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomena. That's how fascinating.
Right.
I was so fascinated with all these, and your father was like a hero to me in the field of ufology after he got out of Project Blue Book.
Right, right.
And I just thought it was so remarkable that he would make such a change with himself in his own belief system.
Yeah, I have great respect for adults who make changes in their belief system, no matter what that change is.
Exactly. Exactly. And gosh, I wish he were still with us.
Me too.
Of course, that would make him, what, 110?
Yeah, but I mean, he saw enough UFO stuff that maybe he found some super anti-aging recipes.
Absolutely. Paul, we're going to take calls with you in our final hour just ahead, giving our great listeners a wonderful opportunity to chat with you. They're into UFOs. They've been into UFOs for a long time. So your name, of course, brings that strength. When people hear your last name, do they know your father? Do they bring that up? And I mean people who aren't associated with ufology or the movie or the show.
Yeah, you know, in sort of general day-to-day life, usually it's they ask me how to spell it a couple times because it's kind of a strange name. But then every now and then someone will say, wait a second, you're not related to the astronomer, are you? And I'll say, yes, that's my father. I'll say, no way, oh my gosh, I've read all of his books, yada, yada, yada.
I love it. Stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment with Paul Hynek. We will take your phone calls. Here's an opportunity to talk with someone who is as close to one of the greatest ufologists ever. Next.